Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner. And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How are you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, some pretty wild times going on right now. We have right now the Supreme Court. Looks like they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I just want to give you some props, Dig. Back on our first show back, episode 40, you were talking about how the conservatives or Republicans, when it comes to reproductive rights, because we were talking about that Alabama story where they were going to require a woman to show proof of not being pregnant before she gets medical cannabis. And you wanted to point out, and you did point out that, you know, these Republicans, they are not going to stop with just reproductive rights and just this one little Alabama thing. They're just going to keep on going. And sure enough, that is what they're doing.
Yeah. And I want everyone to think about, like, you know, everyone's kind of got something they like to do, right? That the Republican Party doesn't like. Like, you know, maybe you like to smoke weed. You know, it doesn't matter what they say. They've appointed people that are anti-cannabis. They've done anti-cannabis things in states that are controlled by Republicans. It's slow to pass. I'm not saying the Democrats are pro-cannabis, just that the Republicans are pretty anti-cannabis. Maybe you smoke cannabis. Maybe you're interested in psychedelics. Maybe you like to have a kind of music that's not very clean. You like adult themed stuff. Whatever it is that you like, the Republicans are going to come after it if it's a little bit forbidden or if it's considered part of the counterculture or counter Christian. Because remember, like, this is Christo fascism. We're past the Republicans being about small government or about liberty. This is all about taking the Christian agenda national.
Yeah, and it said right there in Alito's decision that they wanted to, which is not final yet, but it's looking like they're going to go along with it. But they want to roll back this on the grounds that the Constitution doesn't say it's okay that you can make these types of decisions. And like you said, that's going to put open lots and lots of other cases. But you know they won't overturn the cases that benefit things that they're interested in, like guns and more police and searching your house or pulling you over in your car. You know, all those Supreme Court cases will stand. But like you said, other ones that are more considered counterculture, like gay marriage, and we're just going to call it right here on the Cannabis Corner, they're not going to do anything for pro-cannabis for sure.
No. And yeah, I think gay rights are definitely in danger, especially in the South.
And before we get on to our news, I just want to mention this week for our interview, we have Mike Bologna of Dip Devices and Benita Money of the National Diversity and Inclusion Cannabis Alliance, Indica, on as our guests. And they're going to be talking about cannabis social equity and a partnership between those two organizations. And so stay tuned to that.
Yeah, cool. Stay tuned.
And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
All right, for our first news story, we are going to stay right here close to home. And as everybody has been hearing on the news, we've had a lot of cannabis robberies. You can tune back into episode 40. We cover some of the bigger ones recently, and they are still going on. I just heard of one the other day that I don't recall where it was, but these are still happening in Washington. And King County is just about to pass some an ordinance or a resolution to create a task force that is going to study how to fix this. And as in general, the cannabis, we definitely support trying to figure out something to do with about this, which is we just need more banking for the cannabis industry. But we do have some concerns with this task force, and one of those is they're wanting to increase police presence at cannabis shops.
Yeah, it seems like one of the main aspects that they're talking about doing. Now, I will give them credit. This task force is trying to devote some time to lobbying for safe banking, but I see a focus from them on increasing law enforcement presence outside cannabis retailers. And a lot of times law enforcement can actually escalate violent situations rather than de-escalating them. And I personally, if I was going to go to a Washington licensed cannabis shop and there was a police officer present all the time, I would probably refrain going to licensed retailers in my area and probably go elsewhere to buy my cannabis.
Yeah, I would have to say I'd be a little bit wary going to a cannabis shop with the police there. But, you know, it's desperate times. But I really wish the government would focus a little bit more. Instead of putting more money in law enforcement, let's try to create a system and a society where people don't have to rob the cannabis shops to get by and make themselves feel secure. But
right. And safe banking would solve all of this. The reason that people are violently knocking over cannabis shops is because they know they have tons of cash on hand. You get rid of that cash on hand, you get them into banking. This is solved overnight.
Yeah, and there could be some good things come out of this, because one of the solutions that has been talked about for fixing the cannabis banking problems is things like a state bank or things like that. So there actually could be some good things come out of this. But
oh, like a state bank that's just the state cannabis bank.
Or will it be like a state bank for everybody, but since it's run by the state and cannabis is legal here, that you could make loans and put your money in deposit there? Because what's really stopping cannabis is the federal prohibition. It's a Schedule One narcotic, but it's like the credit cards and the Visa and MasterCard and all them. Like,
yeah,
they will not allow your debit card to be associated with paying for cannabis because of those federal restrictions. And frankly, I don't even know if they get lifted if giant corporations like Visa and the other big banks, will they even be into supporting cannabis businesses? I have a feeling some of them won't.
Well, so I've been into some dispensaries that have figured out a way by hook or by crook to allow debit card transactions. It really doesn't last very long. But when they do it, it usually doesn't show up as an obvious cannabis company in your statement.
Yeah, and I know another one. I'm thinking this might be one of the solutions come out of this task force is they're talking about using more cryptocurrencies in cannabis dispensaries. So,
oh God, okay, yay, awesome.
Yeah, these types of solutions they pose a big problem for me because of accessibility issues.
I don't like this crypto drive. It's obviously a money laundering, gambling thing to an even more discreet. Like it's this whole other topic. We won't get into it, but it's bad for the environment. And it's bad for the working class, but let's just not get into it.
Yeah. All right. So the next story we have comes out of Oregon, and this story involves six workers that walked off a job down there in Oregon. It was a cannabis grow, and they walked off the job complaining that they weren't getting trained enough, things like fire drills, things like how to work with pesticides. And they were fired from their job, and they have they were trying to start a union with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and they walked off the job, and they ended up getting fired.
Yeah, Lucas, this is a really interesting case, and the company that they worked for is called CBN Holdings. I couldn't find too much more information about it than that. So I dug a little deeper, and I'm going to dig a little deeper and try to find a little more information. I couldn't find the retail end of this operation. Like, I don't know what they're called in stores. I did a little research, and I've got some contact numbers I can try to call to figure that out. Because I know myself and our listeners are probably curious as to what the retail name of this operation is, so we can maybe, you know, avoid crossing a picket line. But I was unable to find an actual like open trade name for them, like, you know, what the packaging of this weed might say. So I'm going to do a little digging and maybe call the owner of this corporation and try to find out.
All right. Just wanted to bring the audience up to date on that. And it looks like it's we're having unionizations all over the country. So the cannabis industry is definitely a ripe ground for some unions to get in there.
Right. And what I want people to understand about the modern day cannabis industry is while before, in kind of the heady days of the outlaw cannabis industry, when people were getting paid exorbitant amount of money to process cannabis, now it's more of a farm labor job where people are getting paid below their market value, whereas they probably should be getting paid anywhere from $20 to $21. They're getting paid like $13 to $15 an hour on these farms. So they're getting underpaid. So it's a right place for organizing. Just be careful out there. Be safe and do your homework.
Up next in the news is a story, and we are going to bring you up to date on a Politico that many of you probably have not heard in the news for a while, and that is the ex-Speaker of the House, the ex-Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner. And I'm sorry, I was actually going to try to say Boehner there, but I slipped up and said Boehner, and I blame it on an old radio host I used to listen to back in John Boehner's time, Norman Goldman. It's all his fault. He used to call him John Boehner. So I'm going to try not to say that during this news segment.
Chicken crap.
But as many people remember, back in 2018, John Boehner just all of a sudden said he was pro-cannabis. He was like, I'm going to get into the cannabis space. And I think he's from over there in Ohio or something. And I remember at the time, I was just like shaking my head like, okay, this guy is up to something, dig.
Chicken crap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he has such a history with anti-cannabis voting, and he's associated with the war on drugs, being the Republican Speaker of the House. And so for him to go all in on cannabis, folks, if you ever run into these people that all of a sudden see the light after a lifetime of, I don't know what else to call it, police state anti-cannabis thuggery, you should probably be skeptical of them.
Chicken crap.
And so the story goes that John Boehner was working with what is called the 10 campaign. And we tried to look this up and find out exactly what the 10 campaign was, and were pretty stifled between Dig and I. We were really unable to find anything what the 10 campaign was, but apparently it was like a cannabis pro-legalization group or something. And John Boehner came along, or the head of the group said, hey, John Boehner, why don't you come over here and help me with this? And Boehner came over, and there was some proprietary information shared. And then usually when this happens, they have like the non-disclosure agreement signed.
Yes, they're accusing Mr. Boehner of violating a non-disclosure agreement.
Chicken crap.
But he did. It's not just that. He violated the non-disclosure agreement and then went and started a entirely new organization called the National Cannabis Roundtable. And the lawsuit says that Boehner basically just stole all the talking points and all that proprietary information and just used it and flipped it over into the National Cannabis Roundtable, which, I mean, that's what the accusation is in the lawsuit. But it's interesting that we cannot find anything on the 10 campaign. That's interesting.
It is weird. Usually I could find something.
So the last news story that we're going to get to before we get into our interview with Mike and Bo here in a minute is a update of some things that we've been covering before, and that is what's going on with the psilocybin movement around the country. And one of the stories I wanted to talk about is they actually passed a bill over in Utah, Dig, that would begin studying or open the door to studying how psilocybin would actually help mental health there in Utah. I found that one really fascinating.
Yeah, apparently there's a healthy medical cannabis scene in Utah, and apparently there's a little bit of some psychedelic movement over there. And what's interesting to me is Utah has the reputation for being completely controlled by what's the proper name of the Mormon Church?
The Church of Jesus. I grew up Mormon, so I know. It's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Okay, so the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints pretty much runs the politics over there in large part. So for this to happen, it makes me wonder if that church is starting to see the light on some plant medicines. That's all I'm wondering. That's all I've got, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I know they have a thing called the Word of Wisdom, which that's why they don't drink coffee and cigarettes. And that's one of the reasons why I left the church. You don't want to get all into my church history. It goes long and boring. But it was really hard to follow all that. And I was like, it's just kind of one of the things that kind of interests me about the church. But I think it's some of the, and also, you know, whatever you want to say about the Mormons, they are deeply compassionate people at times for a lot of things. And I think there's a lot of mental health issues going on in Utah, and I think they're seeing it as a way to help people too. So that is a good thing. And then another one, I just got an email from Connecticut, and then Connecticut is doing the same thing. They are actually opening the door for researching and trying to get actually create a market there in Connecticut to distribute psilocybin.
Okay, interesting.
And then, of course, we have the movement there in Oregon, which has already passed. And I just saw that a company called Field Trips, which does psychedelic journeys, I think they started down in California, is coming to Oregon. They did some kind of corporate thing and split their company. So you should start seeing those showing up there in Oregon somewhere where you can actually go and take psilocybin in a controlled environment.
I would caution folks that would come to Oregon to experience our so-called legalized drugs policy to remember that while maybe some of these reforms are being implemented in the police in some of the bigger cities in Oregon, in the rural Oregon, the sheriffs will do to you what they're going to do to you, and no one can stop them. So just be mindful of your surroundings before you come here to use psychedelics. Not everywhere is a safe space. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, it would just be interesting to me. Let's say you live like in South Carolina and you want to come to Oregon and do a trip and then go back. Just that whole thing, like flying all the way across the country and then taking like a massive psychedelic trip and then having to get back on the plane and fly back home. That whole thing seems like not something that would be super productive. Now, I think it could help if you could stay there for a while. But one of my problems always found with psychedelics that I didn't appreciate was the immediacy of having to get back into the real world. So if we're going to be using psychedelics for mental health, that's something that I think that people should consider if they're going to try to be doing these so-called psychedelic tourism, which I feel is like going to be a thing in Oregon soon.
Yeah, yeah, yes, recovery, not to get too much into psychedelics. I think if you're thinking about trying any new substance that you haven't used before, even cannabis, if you're coming to the cannabis corner, welcome, and you haven't smoked cannabis, have a day after to kind of recover from whatever new, you know, substance you're going to put in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Is always a good policy because different people react differently. And some people have incredibly low tolerances.
And then just real quick, right here in Washington, we actually had a bill that was introduced. It had a lot of testimony, but it didn't go anywhere. There also is a psilocybin initiative that they're trying to get on the ballot in November. And there's a couple different efforts on that note, so keep an eye on that. And then finally, one more thing, and I'm actually going to try to get these folks on the show, Dig. I just sent out the email today. He replied back, and I wasn't able to look at it. There is actually coming the first FDA-approved psychedelic psilocybin study that they're going to use real psilocin from mushrooms. It's not going to be synthesized. They're actually going to be extracting it. There's a corporation out of Canada that's going to be working with this research study. So I'm going to be covering that for ganjapreneurs.com, and I'm also going to try to get those people on the air on the Cannabis Corner to talk to us all about this psilocybin renaissance and what is actually going on with psilocybin when we take it. I'm interested to learn more about this myself.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And we are back on the Cannabis Corner for this week's interview, and we are really happy today to be joined by Mike of Dip Devices and Bonita of the National Diversity and Inclusion Cannabis Alliance, and they are here today to talk about a partnership between Dip Devices and the organization and a couple other things. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you for having us.
Hey, I'm doing really well. Really excited to have the conversation.
Yeah, so before we get into what we're going to be talking about, just check in with you guys real quick. Introduce yourself and talk about, just for a minute, how did you get so passionate about the topic of cannabis?
This is Mike Bologna speaking. I'm the CEO of Dip Devices. First and foremost, I was a cannabis user going on almost 20 years now. So for a really significant portion of my life. And I only became more involved in the cannabis industry over the last about 6 years of my career. And very quickly after becoming professionally involved in cannabis is when I became educated and very passionate about the policy side, the equity side of the cannabis industry. And that's what led me to working in Dip Devices, to working with Bo.
Yeah, and for me, I'm Bonita Money. I am the executive director and founder of Indica, which is the National Diversity and Inclusion Cannabis Alliance. And for me, I went into the space around the same time, 6-7 years ago. And what I found was that there weren't a lot of folks that looked like me. It was just a very white industry, mainly male. And I just felt that there needed to be a platform to represent these folks in the industry, because basically, you know, this industry was built on the backs of, you know, black and brown folks, and then they were being shut out of the industry, which was very disturbing. So, you know, for me, it was about creating equity, true equity and ownership for black and brown folks in the industry. And like Mike said, that the policy equity piece is a very important piece for us, because it's a $1 billion industry that folks are making a lot of money. And then you have a lot of politicians that were part of the war on drugs and, you know, put folks in prison. And now there's CEOs of some of the, well, or on the board of some of the largest cannabis companies. So that's how I got involved.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to go ahead and talk about some of the effects that the we called on this show the War on Cannabis, and it was part of the War on Drugs. But it started almost 100 or started over 100 years ago, and then progressed all the way up through the 20th century, and still going on today. There's still statistics all over that a black man's four plus times more likely to get arrested than his white counterpart, even though black and white men use cannabis, or black and white people use cannabis at the same rate. So the war on drug is still going on. So let's just talk about, like, what are some of those effects that we see in neighborhoods and families from the war on cannabis, like poverty, mass incarceration, and things of that nature?
Yeah, very true. And that is the big problem, because our communities are still suffering. So, you know, we have all these marginalized communities of color that are still suffering and traumatized from the effects of the war on drugs. And this is problematic. So, you know, again, there's a lot of money around cannabis, around the industry, but it's not, you know, it's not seeping into the communities. And, you know, we need to have community reinvestment, because, you know, folks are unemployed. There's a lot of crime. I mean, just through COVID, I would say violent crimes, homicides went up 200%. And this is just a lack there. It's because there's a lack of you know, employment, education, mentorship, all that. So these are things that we really, really need to take a look at and create solutions for.
Yeah, Bo is certainly the expert on this, and that's a large part of why we work together. And, you know, just to add to some of the specifics, I think, Lucas, you really touched on them with, you know, first and foremost, the mass incarceration and its horrendously racially slanted statistics. And I think that, you know, that fundamentally undermines the ability to build a community when you have so many people being criminalized and put into the criminal justice system for, you know, something that we really know to be not only not harmful, but in many cases beneficial. And, you know, overall, I think it was just one piece of the systemic oppression and, you know, and the structure that has been built to, you know, to benefit the few. And as Bo mentioned, is, you know, a problem in the cannabis industry specifically, as well in large part for people who are male, or people who are white and male, generally make up the demographics of where these, you know, systems work. And the communities of black and brown individuals are generally where we see the most enforcement out of the, you know, the flip side of the same system. And so, you know, I think that the impact that the war on drugs or the war on cannabis has had really can't be understated and absolutely needs to be addressed.
That certainly is the experience I have noticed here in Washington State. We had a medical cannabis system that was built by a lot of black and brown people. And then once 502 hit, a lot of white individuals with money kind of came in and swooped up a lot of the market. And they are still trying to fix that today with a social equity system that is moving ahead, but is still having some problems. But I really wanted to ask you, so what specifically, if somebody's out there listening and they are a owner of a cannabis business or in the cannabis industry and they're making millions of dollars, what can some of these businesses do to support social equity, in particular, like in their own office culture and at their own businesses?
I would say a big part of being successful as a social equity applicant or operator is definitely mentorship, because folks really need that guidance in the legal, you know, in the legal industry, because a lot of these folks are legacy, you know, they're legacy folks, and they don't understand the regulations, compliance, and, you know, it's very difficult for even seasoned operators in the legal market to even navigate around. So it's that mentorship's really important. They need access to capital. You know, that's very important. And, you know, overall, I would just say that they need resources and support, because we have not had one successful social equity program yet, and it's been about 5 years since we launched.
And I would add, with starting by a little bit of a clarification to your question, you asked, you know, what some of these businesses can do and had a qualifier in there if they're making millions of dollars. And I think it is imperative that every individual and organization is considering social equity core to their participation in this industry, regardless of their financial performance, especially building it from the beginning so that it is habit like breathing by the time that they're hopefully fortunate enough to be making millions of dollars. I just think that that's it's a core piece of participation. And you know, Bo touched on some of the ways that we can help the individuals working through the social equity programs, many of which leave a lot to be desired. But as a brand, I'll sort of talk about some of the things that, you know, the organizations unrelated to the license side can do. First and foremost, that mentorship and hiring practices are, you know, that's universal, and the staff that you bring on and the way that you train and provide the resources, I think is very important, especially understanding that many of the people who have been impacted by the war on drugs struggle to find employment once they leave the incarceration cycle as a result of their record. And so, you know, immediately making that, you know, something that's not a factor, I think is, you know, one of those sort of no-brainer decisions that is specific. But also, I think, you know, partnering with organizations like Bose and, you know, there are other community groups or, you know, national organizations that are focused on social equity and figuring out how to impact their programs and to work with within the framework that they're already dedicating themselves to. That's sort of a way to jump ahead and make sure that you're doing things in a way that's supported by the community, that's integrated with the community, and understand that you know, that the impact that they're doing is so critical, and it's overwhelmingly important for the industry as a whole, not just for the individuals or the individual organizations.
Yeah, good point there, Mike, and thanks for clarifying that. The businesses should be starting with social equity from the very beginning. Bo, I wanted to ask you, how has this partnership, or tell us real quick about the partnership you are working or you have with DIP Devices, and how has that specifically helped your organization?
Well, I think it's assisted in creating awareness around the initiatives that we have and our work throughout the nation, and that's very important, because a lot of us are grassroots organizations, so we don't get a lot of support. We just started getting funded governmentally in 2019, but before that, you know, we were self-funded because we're still federally illegal. There's not many grants or, you know, resources for us. So we became state funded by the governor's office in California in 2019, and then in 2020 in Chicago. But other than that, we don't get a lot of support. So partnerships like this mean everything for us, because, you know, we definitely need that support in a lot of different ways, because there's a lot of resources that DIP Devices can bring to the table for us, as far as, you know, just their social media outreach, their mentorship. Because a lot of them are skilled professionals in this industry, and we have a lot of new up-and-coming social equity applicants and license holders that need that type of support and mentorship. So, you know, in a lot of ways, this definitely benefits our organization and other organizations that need this. So, you know, we'd like to see, you know, definitely more company support like DIP Devices is doing. So we're very grateful for this partnership.
And Mike, do you want to get a little specific and tell us some of the details of the partnership?
Sure, I'd love to. We have been donating a percentage of the sales proceeds of all of our devices to various organizations based on the specific color of each device. And it's sort of been a way to allow us to reach out to multiple organizations and be impactful in a variety of areas. It allows the consumers to feel a little more ownership in their purchase decision and understanding that where their dollars are going. And we had for a while, the last few years at least, been donating to the NAACP Legal and Defense Fund for racial injustice in general. And we had been donating to multiple drug policy organizations, which we do still support. But when I had the opportunity to meet Bo in person, I was just really struck by her vision, her organization, and the impact that they were setting out to have. I've met a lot of people who are doing this type of work, and I can't say enough good things about them. But Bo specifically struck me as just a really, really dedicated individual who had set her organization up to be truly impactful to the individuals that they were serving, and focus less on some of the education or the just kind of like the general information, but really focused on step by step impact to provide a path and the tools necessary to follow that path to, like I keep saying, just really make an impact in communities and on individuals. So, after those conversations, we switched the pointing of where those proceeds went for all of our black devices, which is our most popular selling color. And we have a range of devices. Not every device has the same color, but we do have a black model for each of our devices, and it is always our most popular device. And so now a portion of each of those device sales goes to support Indica and the wonderful work that they're doing. So we wanted to be impactful on a direct level. And while the NAACP Legal and Defense Fund certainly does amazing, amazing, amazing work, I feel that our support is a little smaller and less directly impactful because of their size and their scope than, as you just heard Bo speaking about, our ability to raise awareness, or, every dollar that goes into her organization, how much more it's able to, be helped and felt immediately. We just saw the opportunity for, to use our reach in a way with an organization that we really believed in the work.
All right. Really good to hear, Mike. So if a young person would like to get into the cannabis industry in the way that you have, Mike, which is building devices to use cannabis, and there's a lot of technology goes into that, what are some of the career paths that a young person could take to help them reach some of those goals?
One of my favorite things about the cannabis industry is that, it's really a very universal industry and a very, universal plant and consumption experience. I've met people from every kind of background, demographically, geographically, educationally, and they're all given an opportunity in the industry. It is certainly, not as wide open as we would like it, as discussed earlier in the call on, some of the current demographics as to what the industry is made up of. But I feel that really any individual who has a mindset and an effort set has an opportunity to break into the industry in a way that I have not felt in other places that I've worked. And specifically, the skill sets that individuals have can be applied here, and many traditional career paths can be applied in cannabis. We are an agricultural commodity. We sell widgets. These are very common things in mature established industries. And so many people only think about the growers or the licensed dispensaries, but there's so many supporting support roles and ancillary staff. We have everything that a traditional business has. So, you know, legal and accounting and finance, specifically your question touched on, you know, to design our products. And so there's all sorts of product engineering and electrical engineering, manufacturing, you know, some roles that, you know, we fill on marketing or social media management. There's really a wide skill set. And I think our industry tends to value experience even more so than education, where, you know, some other industries may have that flipped in terms of how they evaluate resumes. But I think, you know, it is one that I just really want to support it, that if somebody is interested in getting into the industry, that they strongly consider it and don't disqualify themselves because they say, oh, you know, they don't need A, B, and C in cannabis, because we usually do.
I agree with Mike. It's because, again, a lot of these folks have that experience in the legacy market, and I think they should utilize it. And also, a lot of our skill sets that we possess, we can just kind of like now transition that into cannabis. So, you know, if someone is interested in marketing, sales, or whatever that looks like, they can use that skill set towards, you know, being in the industry. And I just think that because it's so new, a lot of folks don't know what it takes to qualify, or, you know, or they may have convictions that they think are going to keep them out of the industry. And so I think it's important that they know that it's wide open, because cannabis companies really encourage folks that do have criminal records to apply. So I think that's something that, you know, folks need to understand as well. Don't, you know, don't disqualify themselves, because a lot of folks don't enter into the industry thinking that careers are already preset for them.
Yeah, that's good advice, Bo. I know a couple of people who have some criminal records who have been real hesitant to get into the industry. So that is really good information to get out there, that some businesses are actually looking to help people that have been incarcerated. And it's only for owners or higher up that they'll do a background check. So it's not all businesses are looking to a background check and all that. So, Mike, I wanted to ask you, last episode I reviewed the Lunar, and I really like it. It's a really sleek little dip device, and it works really good for me as a blind person, like you mentioned. It's really hard to use a dab rig and everything. And I was looking at it. You can take it apart. It has some really intricate pieces to it and everything. What goes into making a product like that?
You know, we're very fortunate to have a product designer that really understands the cannabis product, and a strong manufacturing team to help us take our ideas and put it into life. But first and foremost, it definitely takes a passion for cannabis and cannabis concentrates, a desire to build a better product that customers can rely on. And I do appreciate your kind words. So, you know, our product process really starts with identifying a need. In this case, an affordable, reliable, portable concentrate pen. And we identify what's on the market, ways that we can improve. In our case, it's a very strong, very reliable battery, and the way that the airflow interacts with the heating elements to make a fresher, more efficient, more flavorful experience. And once we sort of identified the need, identified some areas where we can make improvements from any technology that's out there, we go into a prototyping phase where we get a couple versions of the devices. And, you know, this is always a very challenging part of my job. I like to joke about our product development testing phase. And, you know, truly I'm doing work by, you know, testing multiple different devices and, you know, try to go through as much cannabis as I can to see how it holds up against wear and tear and things like that. So, you know, it's an important critical stage, but it is also, you know, an exciting one in the project to hold something physically and try it out. And from there, we sort of finalized the design and put it into manufacturing. And you know, from there, the true challenge begins, which is in the product distribution, the education, the sales, and you know what we think is a good idea or works really well. You know, it's only as successful as the market says. And so getting customer feedback and incorporating that into future manufacturing, either of the same device or a future device, is super critical to the process as well.
Before Zoom cuts us off here, I would like to thank you guys for coming on the show. So tell the audience before we get out of here, how can they get in touch with you and learn more about your organizations?
I'd go first. We're at Dip Devices on all the major social media, or dipdevices.com. And you know, the biggest takeaway that I'd hope that you guys take from this is, or the listeners take from it, is just how important social equity is, and that everybody can get involved in the cannabis industry, but those who do really need to recognize the challenges that preceded the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And I highly recommend that everybody listening looks Indica up, looks into the work that they're doing and why it's so important. And you know, Lucas, thank you for giving both of us a platform here today.
Yes, we appreciate that, Lucas, very much. Thank you. And so for Indica, you can reach us at on IG. We're The Indica. So it's, there's no I, so just so people know, it's THENDICA 18. So it's The Indica 18. And then it's just the National Diversity and Inclusion Cannabis Alliance on LinkedIn, Facebook. And definitely go to our website, which is theindica.org. And you know, if you are looking to get into the industry and you feel that there's challenges and barriers, we'd definitely like to assist. So please look us up, definitely. And we're nationwide, so, you know, we can help anywhere. And there's a lot of new programs being rolled out as far as social equity in different states. And so I get a lot of calls from newbies that really are confused about the process of even applying. So we encourage them to definitely reach out.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
And now we are back to our It's a Bus segment, and this week we are coming on back up here to Oregon in Diggs area, Josephine County, Oregon, which I drove through there last year when I took our vacation down to California. Didn't get to stay very much, but it's kind of mountainous, a lot of it. It was a little different than I expected. It's like a little more rocky than I expected it to be down there.
But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a interesting part of the world. And in this case, it was an older lady. It sounds to me like she was left behind when there was a cannabis bust. And what happened down there in Josephine, Oregon, Dig?
So there was, on April 28th, the police in Josephine County raided an illegal outdoor marijuana farm in Grants Pass. They said they seized 7,600 cannabis plants, as well as growing equipment, multiple firearms. They said that it's rare to find people and arrest them at these places. And like you said, she might have just been slow getting away, it sounds like. The local police made sure to tell the local news that it's rare to find very many arrests at the illegal grows, which are often manned by undocumented and sometimes trafficked labor. They're pushing this really hard, this whole undocumented and trafficked labor. And while it is a problem on illicit cannabis grows, I think as many cartel or foreign run grows as you'll find in the hills around Josephine and Jackson and Josephine counties in Oregon, there are as many mom and pop operations that are people that have been operating in this area for years that are actually local. So people should keep that in mind, that it's a local problem as much as it is people from outside coming in.
Yeah, and they're going to push that foreign thing with people coming in doing that because of the part of the country it is. And it is still the United States, so they love to push that racist thing going on to kind of garner support because they just passed a big thing in the Oregon legislature to pump a bunch of money in the Southern Oregon. So I'm afraid we're going to be seeing a lot more of these. And
This is going to become – it's going to become very common down here very soon. You're going to see – increased police presence in the rural areas. You're gonna see more and more of these busts, and you're gonna see some people held accountable, but for the most part, most people are not going to be held accountable.
Yeah, and I was going to say it at the beginning, it's a bust. I mean, the drug war is just going crazy right now. I'm seeing like every day 300-pound busts, 250-pound busts. Nebraska is always getting some major, massive busts. So,
well,
the cannabis drug war is still going on out there, folks.
Here's the thing. Cannabis is getting more and more popular without the legal farming infrastructure to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So as a country, by not legalizing cannabis, this is the cannabis industry we've chosen to have. You cannot not have a cannabis industry. You don't get to not have one. You have a cannabis industry in this country, whether you want one or not. So now we get to decide what kind of cannabis industry we want. Do we want it outlaw and illegal with constant police harassment? Or do we want it legal? The choice is ours to make.
All right. I really want to thank our guests, Mike and Bo, for being on the show this week. And I want to thank our sponsors and for you listening to the show. And I want to thank you, Dick, for being on the show with me today. I hope you have a great week.
Hey, you too.
Chicken crap.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.